Today, on the eve of the general election, we hear about an amazing project from The Guardian Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle describing the lives of people who died sleeping rough in Britain. And divisive electioneering targeting Britain's Hindus. You've spent a year doing this amazing series on homelessness. What were you expecting when you began?
I don't really know what we were expecting. I think it probably shocked us a bit more than we thought, but also pleased us a bit more. It's probably been a bit more emotional than we thought. I think we've come out of it probably with more friends. We've probably come out with it a bit even angrier than we thought we would. What do you think, Dan?
I mean, I was already angry to begin with because I've experienced some of this stuff myself. I've seen the way that some of these services operate. I've lost a homeless friend who drowned in the River Tame Canal. So I was already close to this issue to begin with. So you can't be not angry with the injustice, you know. So you get upset.
We do loads of midnight crying, don't
midnight
we?
Midnight crying.
Pathetic. We're really soppy. We're the opposite of like your macho, kind of hard-nosed, independent journalist. We're just soppy, pathetic gits, really, aren't we? Yeah, it just takes quite a bit out of you, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think you were saying that you don't feel like you have the right to grieve because it's not your loved ones, but you can't help it, you know. Clearly, you know, it's hard.
It was the tents that made Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle want to do something. The tents springing up in stations, shopping centres, tunnels and parks since 2010. They felt these tents, housing the rising number of street homeless, were a vivid symbol of austerity Britain. And then there were the deaths. At least 800 in 18 months. Or at least that's what we think. These are the most vulnerable individuals in Britain, reduced to poorly collected statistics. Which is why Simon and Danny decided to embark on a remarkable journalistic project. The Empty Doorway series isn't just about understanding the deaths of nine homeless people, but telling the stories of their lives. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the lives of Britain's rough sleepers. Lizzie, our producer, and I, in February, went to Oxford after another colleague here at The Guardian had written about the number of homeless people dying in the city. And one of them was Sharon Maz.
She just helped everybody, no matter what day it was. She would always be the cheerful one.
And I think everywhere we went, we kept hearing these flashes of her bubbly, infectious personality.
She always took them under her wing.
Yes.
And would guide them along to cope. And
everyone wanted to tell us about her. I mean, an old head teacher wrote to The Guardian about what a lovely child she'd been. And actually, the conversation we had coming out of that was, we want to tell the story of her life, not her death.
Yeah.
And that's what you've done brilliantly. I mean, tell me about Sharon Maz.
She was a support worker, so she actually spent a lot of time looking after homeless people before she became homeless. She was a victim of domestic abuse,
yeah,
wasn't she?
She'd actually had three kids, and I think she'd taken drugs when she was younger, but I think between 18 and 30, we were told from family that she was really straight, she was really happy, she was looking after the kids brilliantly, and she was working. And it all started with she got involved with someone who was really, really violent, who ended up in prison. She then went to a refuge in Birmingham, but she came back because she was worried about the kids. She had a breakdown. She started taking drugs and drinking again. And she spent 10 years on the streets.
Now, how do you survive?
Oh, that's a good question. For the grace of God, I think.
Yeah. I remember when we looked at her story and there were videos that she'd appeared on in YouTube where she talked about her life. It seemed like she really wanted people to understand her story and know what she wanted to achieve.
Have someone to live. My children are with me. And just be back, you know, to living like a normal person. Yeah, that's my three wishes, yeah.
She knew what she wanted to say. It was, you know, don't judge a book by its cover.
Take a step back and look. Don't just judge a book by its cover yet. Why don't you take a look and open it up and have a look inside it?
You know, she was, even when she was wrecked, and, you know, you look at some of the films, you could tell she was wrecked, but she was really eloquent.
How did you go about finding out about her? Who did you talk to?
So what we did is we just ended up walking around Oxford, didn't we? We went to the fairground and sort of had a guided tour by this homeless man with a limp. He said he knew of someone who knew her, and he took us all around the houses, didn't he? And then just before we got there, he says, right, that give us a tenner then. And it's just down there, fiver, just down there. Just
don't
down
exaggerate.
There. So we gave him a fiver. And then walked to the bottom of the road and no one was there. So he tricked us.
That was a literal dead end.
Yeah, a literal dead end. But we managed to find out about her life through talking to people who had worked with her.
I mean, you became homeless yourself, didn't you?
When I was 22, yeah.
What happened?
This wonderful woman called Monica Gregory.
Yeah.
And there was like an inverse correlation between their life stories because Monica had been homeless. And another victim of domestic abuse, horrific domestic abuse and horrific violence from her childhood. She became an outreach worker herself and ended up befriending Sharon. And their lives had gone into reverse and they became friends and they became incredibly close. But one of the things Monica said is that one area where they couldn't talk about was she couldn't talk to her about her kids because Monica had managed to keep her kids and she knew it was too painful for Sharon. Mm-hmm. To talk about hers.
We know that Sharon died in supported accommodation. Were you able to find out any more details of what happened?
In the end, she died of a drug overdose and she had cirrhosis of the liver. The coroner said he thought she had signs of hypothermia. But the inquest was quite controversial because it was discovered that there was a man in this women's only accommodation. He called the ambulance, and then when the ambulance arrived and eventually the police arrived, he wasn't there. The controversy was that why was there a man in women's only accommodation? Both Oxfordshire Homeless, which is the charity that runs the place, and the council said because these women were moving towards independence, there wasn't a full-time worker.
What's amazing about what you guys have done is the level of detail that you've gone into in each of these cases. And you did that for nine lives, nine people,
yeah.
Nine people who had died and who you wanted to tell the story of their life. And you wrote epic pieces, I mean, 5,000 to 7,000 word pieces that delved into so many different strands of what was going on. You talk about domestic violence, you talk about drug abuse, alcoholism, you talk about mental illness. I mean, Tell me, what were the things that you saw again and again?
I mean, there were things in common that are really tragic. Like in every case,
drugs.
There's an addict.
Yeah.
It's drugs and alcohol, and it's got much more complicated. So that was really common. And it's interesting that if you look at the difference between Sharon and Monica came out of it, the one thing Monica had going for her was that she was never an addict.
But I also think family problems was at the heart of them all too.
Oh,
so,
God, yeah.
So, you know, Kane Walker, who in Birmingham was in care. Clive Dalrymple had an abusive father. So this is, you can point to all these just dysfunctions.
When you were younger, you were in care. Why do you think, from your own experience and from what you've reported, that being in care makes it more likely that you're going to end up on the streets?
I suppose because being in care, the people supporting you are paid to support you. And then once you become an adult in this country, support is withdrawn from you. So, you know, most people who are adults go to their parents for support. I'm sure most people, if they've got a problem, the first person they call is their parents. Care leavers don't have that support network. So they haven't got any parents to call often.
How did you end up homeless?
I've ended up homeless several times. I suppose I'll talk about the longest period. I was doing a degree at Manchester Metropolitan University, and I just became skint at the end of that. I wasn't managing my finances and stuff. I was getting harassed by my neighbours. My mental health was really bad. And I had a breakdown. I was in massive arrears with my landlord, but I wasn't even evicted. I just left one day and started living in a tent on the canal and in a campsite.
What was that like?
It's just all a haze. I can't even when I think back it now, I don't have any account for any of it.
Did you have any feelings about that whilst you were doing this reporting?
About how it can just go wrong? Yeah, because it sort of runs away from you, you know. I think if you ask a lot of people how did this happen, they'll have a really hard time explaining why. Because there's things that you're not even aware of that are probably contributing to a bad decision you made or losing control. So, yeah. But I think what I would have benefited from was proper support. Because when I went to university, I moved from Oldham to Tameside. And although I was receiving support from aftercare services in Oldham, that wasn't transferred to Tameside. I just thought, I'm at uni now, I don't need the support anymore, I'll be fine. And then you don't notice your own deterioration until it's too late.
Where were you homeless in Tameside? That's where I'm from.
I know, yeah. On the canal. So basically the River Tame, you know, near the River Tame. So on there, and I only did 3 weeks, and then I got into hostels and I spent like 9 months in hostels and stuff.
But Simon, lots of people you wrote about did have loving families.
And it might have been the families that we saw, but the families around them, and this was a real common theme, was that they were incredibly loving. They couldn't have been more loving in a way, but they still had to give up on them to an extent because they reached a point where they had to make a decision. Is it, say, with someone like Catherine Kenny, her sister, Lee Maria, is amazing, but she had to kind of choose between her son and the safety of her son. And even the fear of having her son taken away by having Catherine in the house. And she adored Catherine. She was like the best person. But kind of in the end, she wasn't the best person. She was the second or third best person in her world. She had to make that choice. Yeah, it was really common with all the people we met and who feel that mix of absolute grief and guilt at the same time.
You've been talking about how hard this can be for families. I think sometimes people don't realise what it can be like when someone's got severe mental illness, when they've got drug addiction. Mm. And one of the stories you told was the story of Mark David James Starr, called Humpy, by his family. Tell us about how you went back to find out about him.
How Mark's story came to our attention is that it was a call out in the local paper in Glasgow. Was it Glasgow Live?
Yeah.
And he died in the Glasgow Green area, which is the main park in the city. And no next of kin had been found.
One of the really sad things with Mark's case was that they put out this call out and the family didn't find out for 5 weeks.
They found out when we found out. We followed the call out on social media and tracked down Jude Starr, which is Tony Starr's son. And we got in touch with the family like that.
I loved my brother. Oh, I loved him. And he loved me.
He could be a pain in the arse, but at the end of the day, that was Mark, wasn't it?
That was Mark. That was Humpy.
Who's Tony Starr?
Tony Starr is Mark's brother.
Tony Starr is a star.
And he is a star.
He said, yeah, my mate's going to take me to see Glasgow Rangers. I thought, all right, nice one. I thought he was doing all right.
It's not knowing, isn't it, what... how we lived up there. I mean, was he hungry? Was he cold?
Well, he was hungry, Mum. He was. When he used to come.
What did you know about the case at that point, and how did you find out more?
Humpy sort of, he moved around a lot, and I don't think the family knew much about his life in Glasgow because he didn't tell them.
He didn't say anything like that to me. He always made out he was all right up there.
No, he weren't, Mum. He weren't.
He thought it'd be good to find out about Mark's life in Glasgow with Tony.
Yeah. So he'd always say to Sue, I'm doing great in Glasgow, Mum. I'm brilliant. When I'm settled, you got to come up with Nan. One of the kind of heartbreaking things was that she said, I can't go up because it's too painful for me, but I'd really like you to find out, you know, what his last days were like, what his last months were like. And we were like, what's the biggest thing you want to find out? And she said, was he happy? Tell us if he was happy.
What did you find out about Mark's life in Glasgow?
He had quite a horrible time up there, didn't he?
It was tough.
But I think they told him quite frankly that his situation was desperate. He had complex needs. I think towards the end he was hallucinating. He was obviously addicted to hard drugs, heroin. And he was an entrenched rough sleeper by the end of his life.
Could Tony tell his mum that Humpy had been happy?
No, he couldn't, and he didn't. But what he could say is that the people on the streets are really kind. People cared about him. People liked him.
Just walking around Glasgow, seeing all the homeless people, it feels like that I was, walking in Humpy's footsteps in some way. Felt closer to him in some way.
Really?
Yeah.
As I understand it, in Scotland there's a legal obligation to house people who notify the council that they're homeless. Did they provide that to him?
Humpy was one of those who hadn't been given accommodation when he was legally entitled to it.
Had he made an application?
He had made at least two applications. And even though that was awful to know, Tony then went and addressed the councillor and he said to her, I think my brother might still be alive if he'd got what was due to him. And she had to agree.
She acknowledged him, yeah, didn't she?
And in the end, I think it's a comfort to his family to think that maybe people in future won't die because Mark could be cited in a legal case showing that people were denied accommodation when they needed it.
It sounds to me like in all your cases, as well as similarities between issues that the people were facing, you found similarities in the difficulties they were finding in getting help. I mean, did you see institutional failures across the board?
I think one of the common failures is lack of joined up thinking. And we met two women, Amy and Catherine, who had both come out of prison. Probably shouldn't have been in prison. It was for tiny offences. They'd been in for weeks and they didn't come out to accommodation. I mean, how can that happen? They went straight back onto the streets. And this is a tiny, tiny failing, but it's really significant. In Catherine's case, her street partner, who shared the same doorway with her, had died while she was in prison in that doorway. Her sister, Lee Maria, said to the prison, you've got to tell Catherine that her partner's died. She can't come out and find that he's died. You've got to tell her. The prison decided that it could destabilise her while she was in prison.
Yeah.
So they decided it wasn't a risk worth taking. She came out, she found out, she went on a horrific downward, druggy slope, and within weeks, she was dead in that same doorway.
It's hard to miss the fact that there are more people sleeping on the streets these days, and clearly that has gone up since austerity.
No one talks about the big society anymore, but that was Cameron's flagship policy. It was all about outsourcing services to the private sector, and the theory was that that would pick up the slack from all these cuts. It just hasn't happened. There's no profit motive in looking after really messed up, vulnerable people. And a big problem with them being outsourced is that they're unaccountable. So journalists can't hold a lot of these services to account because we asked them just basic questions about the services they had. And they're, no, we're not telling you. And they don't have to. You can't FOI them.
We don't think it's relevant.
And again,
that's not what we want to talk about.
If they were in public hands, then they would be accountable and they would be regulated, I think.
Figures are kind of horrific. I just underlined some here. It says at least 320,000 people are homeless, according to sheltered statistics. Almost 5,000 are rough sleeping, which is likely to be a huge underestimate. 726 people died homeless in England and Wales in 2018. That means on the street, basically. And that's a 22% rise from 2017. And I think in every story we told, every life, you can see the impact austerity had. Jake Hum, he had the social thing that he went to shut down a month before he died. The grant was for £5,000 and it did so much good. It's called A Room to Rant. The people who ran that, we went to see them. They said we had to close down. We couldn't get the money because they said they couldn't measure our effectiveness. And they said the only way they could measure their effectiveness in the end was by the fact that someone like Jake had taken his life and other people had since gone on the off the rails. Now, they couldn't say that had killed them. Of course they couldn't. Or that had led them, to them going off the rails. But they were pretty sure it had a significant factor in it. With Catherine Kenny, before she died, her sister, Lee Maria, was phoning around saying, my sister needs rehab. She needs rehab. She needs urgent rehab. Please take her. She needs rehab. She was told, come back in 3 weeks, yeah, and we'll see if she's fit for rehab, and then we'll decide. And yeah. She was dead 4 days later.
And then if you look at Clive Dalrymple, I think it shows how the NHS is stretched to the limits. He discharged himself the day after undergoing heart surgery. And we don't know if the hospital did a mental health assessment because they can't discuss individual cases. But I just think the fact that someone like Clive, who was mentally ill, was allowed to check himself out of hospital. And you see examples of that, other examples of it all the time.
It's resources, all the time.
It's just,
resources.
There's just no resources.
You know, with Kane Walker, right? His friends called the ambulance in the morning. He'd taken a drug overdose. The ambulance came, right? And he was in his sleeping bag. He said, I don't want to come in. I don't want to get in. He was like in a terrible state. So the ambulance just went away. Yeah. The ambulance had to be called later that day. By the time they were there, he was dead.
What did you learn from this about how to stop deaths happening?
There's some really good people working in charities, really good people working in the third sector and private organisations, but they all have different philosophies, and it makes the quality of support potluck from postcode to postcode, and even sometimes within the same postcode. So there needs to be joined up, they need to be brought back into public hands, and they need to be properly funded.
At the moment, a lot of places and councils would say someone has to be tenancy ready to move into a home, i.e. if they're drinking, if they're on drugs, they're not tenancy ready. Yeah. So Hamid, for example, said, they said, we'll give you a house, but you can't be drinking, you can't be taking drugs. He said, bollocks to that. You know, I'm an addict. Of course I'm going to be drinking or taking drugs.
And that's clearly a key point in every case you investigated. People need homes, but they've all got incredibly complex needs. Is there an approach that can cope with that?
One of the things is housing first, which is really, really expensive and has been successful in Finland and even in New York. With Housing First, how it works, you acknowledge these people have huge entrenched problems, but you give them a home and you have wraparound care with it. So as soon as you're in there, you've got your mental health team, you've got your addiction team, and the relative expense of having someone in prison or having to treat them through the NHS with really expensive drugs, you know, it is expensive, but it's not that expensive in the end.
So is this being used?
It's not national policy by any means at the moment, but they are rolling out pilot projects. And what people are saying, what some councils are saying at the moment, is that we'd love to give this person a house and give them housing first and the wraparound treatment, but their lives are too chaotic. That's a contradiction of what housing first is supposed to be.
What else could be done?
Well, we could start linking benefits to the cost of living in housing to get rid of no-fault evictions. And often people are considered intentionally homeless by the council, and that's not always fair. Someone might be fleeing domestic abuse or just a really dysfunctional environment at home, and the council might not buy what you're saying, and it's convenient for them to say, well, you've made yourself intentionally homeless, therefore we don't have a duty of care for you. I think they've got to take people at their word.
I think you've got to get rid of the localism law. I think that's a real killer. I mean, literally a killer.
Oh, yeah. Like where I live now in Newham, to qualify for the housing register, you have to be a habitually resident in that borough for up to 2 years. And I think some local authorities, it's a lot longer than that. I think like some parts of London, it's 5 years or 10 years.
What if you've been moving around?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're homeless, you're going to have this transient lifestyle, aren't you? You're not going to have spent long in one location because they do move about.
Tomorrow, this country is going to the polls. We've got a general election that pitches two incredibly ideologically different visions against each other. You guys wrote a piece recently in which I felt like I could feel your pain. You were like screaming at all politicians, screaming to ask why homelessness wasn't at the centre of this campaign. As we think about that election, what would you say from your incredible reporting this year?
What I would say to Labour is they have started talking a bit more about it, but they need to get expert on it. They need to really start understanding the details. They need to understand the services.
Long-term thinking as well, not just thinking what's going to work in the short term. Like, if you go back to the Thatcher era, right to buy your own home, that's great if you're in a council house. It's not really thinking about 30 years down the line when there's no more bloody council houses. So I'd like to see a government not worry about what's sellable to the electorate, but just think about what needs to be done. I mean, hundreds of people dying homeless on the streets is this government's legacy, because it encapsulates everything they're doing wrong with services, the NHS, everything.
Simon, Danny, I found your series inspirational. I think it's been the most amazing journalism done this year at The Guardian, and I think you should both be very proud.
Oh,
thank you for coming in.
Say so, thanks.
Oh, thanks, man.
That was Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle. As I mentioned a few times, they have just completed a brilliant series for The Guardian called The Empty Doorway. Please do go to the website and read it. There's also a film produced by Maeve Shearlaw focusing on the life of Humpy, or Mark Starr, who we heard about in this episode. And also credit to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and their project trying to count the number of people dying on the streets. Coming up, Haroon Sadiq on an election campaign that has become worryingly sectarian. Now, during this election campaign, it emerged that British Hindus were being controversially targeted by WhatsApp messages urging them to vote against Labour, accusing the party of being anti-India. Haroon Sadiq reported on the fallout from the story.
Imagine you're on WhatsApp, communicating with friends or family, and suddenly a message pops up. It says, the Labour Party is now the mouthpiece of the Pakistani government. It is anti-India, anti-Hindu and anti-Modi. So if there are any Indians who are still voting for Labour or are still members of the Labour Party, then respectfully I say they are traitors to their ancestral land, to their family and friends in India and to their cultural heritage. Over the course of this election, I've been following the way in which Hindus have been targeted with messages urging them to vote Conservative. The main things that they're trying to get across in these messages are twofold. Firstly, there's the issue of Kashmir, which is a territory of long-running dispute between India and Pakistan. And at the Labour conference this year, Labour passed a motion supporting independent observers to be sent there after India revoked the territory's autonomous status. They're playing on this to say that Labour are unduly interfering into issues in India which do not concern them. And I think the other thing is that, unfortunately, a lot of these messages are playing to a very anti-Muslim message. It's unclear where all of these messages originate, and that's one of the problems of WhatsApp. But it's not just WhatsApp, it's events, it's rallies, it's leaflets. And in the main, it seems to be driven by people who are not Conservative politicians, but more like prominent members of the Hindu community and outspoken members of the Hindu community whose wish is to see a Conservative government elected. I think Hindus are being targeted across the country. The ruling BJP party in India are a Hindu nationalist party. They have an overseas arm in the UK, which has boasted that it's targeting 48 marginal seats with the intention of delivering a Conservative victory in each of those 48 seats. And they span across the country and are generally in areas where they say that the Hindu vote can be key. But even if all Hindus were to vote en bloc for the Conservatives, they just don't have that kind of power. The Labour Party actually sought to clarify Labour's intentions with regard to Kashmir in the face of that controversial vote at their conference. The party chairman did this by saying that Labour would never interfere in Kashmir and that it did not support one side or the other. That would suggest that they were concerned. A number of people have contacted me expressing concern. They're upset. They feel that this is very divisive and bad for politics in the UK. I spoke to one young woman who said that she was deleting messages from her parents' phone because she was worried that they were sort of being brainwashed and indeed taking these messages at face value. Certainly in my lifetime, this is the most polarised election I've seen in terms of religious groups. We've had the chief rabbi urging the Jewish community not to vote for Labour because of problems with anti-Semitism. We've had the Muslim Council of Britain highlighting issues with Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. And then we also have these Hindu voters being urged to vote Conservative. I think this is a deeply worrying development.
That was Haroon Sadiq. Do read his pieces on the website. My thanks to him and to Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.